Today at Reader's Corner, part two of our interview with Scott Eyman, author of Hank and Jim, The 50-Year Friendship of Henry Fonda and James Stewart. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Today we're continuing our conversation with Scott Eyman about his book Hank and Jim. The book chronicles the long friendship between two Hollywood icons, Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart. Unlike many friendships, theirs wasn't based on shared beliefs about things like religion or politics. In fact, Stewart was a church-going Republican, married to the same woman for 45 years. Fonda was a liberal Democrat and a non-believer who was married five times. Despite these and other differences, Fonda and Stewart found solace in each other's company. They understood each other on a cellular level, and around each other they could have fun and relax. On last week's program, I talked with Scott Eyman about some of the things Stewart and Fonda had in common, including a love of building giant model airplanes, an affection for animals, especially cats, and a shared experience as struggling actors in Depression-era New York City. Today we'll continue our conversation by talking about some of the things that divided them, but that didn't prevent them from being friends or staying friends for nearly a half a century. As I mentioned on last week's show, in this day and age when friendships between people on opposite sides of the political and social spectrum are increasingly rare, the story of Hank and Jim is particularly instructive and it's relevant, and I'm glad we are able to devote 2 weeks of Reader's Corner to it. We'll pick up today's interview with my question to Scott about some of the issues that could have stood in the way of their friendship. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about what could have divided Jimmy Stewart and Henry Fonda, and we're going to start with the most obvious of all, and that's their politics. Tell us about that.
Well, Stewart was a conservative Republican probably from the time his mother's water broke. His father was quite conservative. His father had fought in the Spanish-American War and in World War One. Very military-minded guy. His father owned a big hardware store, one of the biggest stores in Indiana, Pennsylvania. And, you know, he followed his father's politics. Fonda was extremely liberal and had been all his life. Although the defining incident was not his parents' politics, it was a lynching that he saw in Omaha when he was 13 or 14 years old. He was a black man who'd been accused of something involving a white woman, and he was snatched from the Omaha jail, lynched. Then they cut him down and shot him full of bullets. Then they set the corpse on fire. Then they dragged the corpse around the town square. The mayor tried to stop the lynching. He was lynched, but they managed to cut him down before he died. It was a real full-scale race riot. And Fonda observed all this from the window of his father's print shop. His father had a job printing shop in Omaha. And he realized that beneath the pleasant pieties of tipping your hat to somebody in the street and everybody putting money in the collection plate on Sundays, that people can be very, very ugly. Apparently nice, God-fearing people can be very, very ugly. So Fonda never really bought into a lot of the things that Stewart did buy into politically and socially. And his politics never wavered an instant, and neither did Stewart's. They had one argument over politics in 1947, which was over the House Un-American Activities investigation into supposed communist influence in Hollywood. And Stewart thought it was a good idea, and Fonda thought it was a charade. And they had a knockdown, drag-out, verbal argument. And at some point, they both simultaneously realized that they were stomping around on very thin emotional ice. And they also both realized that the friendship mattered much more to them than their specific political ideologies. So they made a mutual agreement to never speak about politics again. And they never did. Never. When Jane Fonda went to North Vietnam and was photographed with the North Vietnamese Army, reporters who knew that they were close friends, that Fonda and Stewart were close friends, would troll Stewart by asking what he thought about his goddaughter and her anti-war activities. And he never, and I'm sure he was appalled and angry. But he would never trash her. He never trashed her to anybody, partially because they had a great affection for each other, he and Jane. But also, he wouldn't do that to Hank, you know? Mm-hmm. So he just bit his tongue and kept his silence. So that was the way they maintained their friendship. They agreed on so much. They agreed about acting. They agreed about music. They both love jazz. Peter Fonda told me that Nat King Cole taught him how to play the piano because after the war they got heavily into West Coast jazz. And, of course, Nat King Cole was a great jazz pianist before he became a well-known ballad singer. So they were both friendly with Nat Cole and Dave Brubeck and all that. So, but they agreed about a lot, you know. So they just simply decided to focus on those things they agreed on rather than focus on the one thing they absolutely disagreed on.
There's another contrast where, in a sense, I think you called Fonda at one point a closet intellectual. And at another point in your book, you quote Stewart as saying, yeah, all these books in the house, I haven't read these books. Gloria reads these books. I'm not a learned man.
Right.
Help us understand that contrast.
He wasn't. Fonda wasn't. Fonda said that his reading was largely magazines and movie scripts. I mean, Stewart said that his reading was largely magazines and scripts. He really didn't read books much. Fonda read everything. One of Fonda's best friends was John O'Hara. Another close friend was John Steinbeck. Now, of course, they would have been attracted to him, Steinbeck, because Fonda was Tom Joad in the Ford movie for all time. I mean, other people have played the part, but it's always Henry Fonda. You know, it's like Marlon Brando and Stanley Kowalski. That's his part. Right. Other guys do it, but they're always juxtaposed against Brando, and it's the same thing with Tom Joad and Fonda. But they didn't talk on that level. They talked about their kids. They talked about their wives. Right. Fonda had five. Stewart had one. So Fonda had more to talk about. And they talked about they didn't even talk about acting. You know, they talked about flying kites. After the war, they built these huge kites because Fonda had seen these signal kites that the Navy used in the South Pacific. And he and Stewart, you know, came back to Hollywood. And besides building the radio-controlled planes, they built these huge kites, you know, 6 and 8 feet tall that could pick you right up if you got a gust of wind. They were so big. And they enjoyed that. And they enjoyed their music. They enjoyed jazz. Stewart was not a bad pianist. He could play the piano fairly well. He played the accordion as well. Fonda didn't really play instruments too well. It wasn't an intellectual decision. It was more of a mutual psychological disposition to focus on the things they both enjoyed.
There was a point the other day when I was talking to somebody about interviewing you for this book. They had heard you on NPR, and the guy said, yeah, well, you know, what I remember about that interview is that Fonda was pretty much of a glass half empty guy and Stewart was a glass half full guy. And I guess that reminds me of when I think you quote Jane Fonda later in her life trying to understand her difficulty with her relationship with her father, saying, you know, he was depressed most of his life or whatever she said. Maybe you can straighten us out on that.
Jane told me she thought if they'd had Prozac, everybody's life would have been a lot easier.
Yeah.
I think that I get what she's saying. I think that's probably a little simplistic.
Mm-hmm.
It's true that he was probably a glass half empty guy. And he had much readier access to his temper than Stewart did. Stewart would rarely lose his temper. When he did, it was ugly because his lips would disappear and his mouth became a white line and he wouldn't raise his voice. You know, but you knew you were in the presence of trouble when Stewart would get angry. Fonda's anger was much closer to the surface. Everybody who knew Fonda saw him at one time or another, you know, get his discontent, his congenital discontent. That's true. That's true. The odd thing is they were so similar as actors, you know. I mean, Stewart's a big actor. He's very emotional. He could be subtle, but he's often large, you know, in the same way that Jimmy Cagney's a big actor, whereas Fonda is all compression. Fonda, you know, an eyebrow, a flick of his eyelids, just a slight tightening of the mouth. You have to look carefully at Fonda to ascertain what's going on, you know, because he's a minimalist actor. But they both saw the business exactly the same way. They both saw acting exactly the same way. Learn the lines backwards and forwards. Respect the script. Otherwise, why are you doing this? You know, if you don't respect the script, if you're trying to rewrite the author, why did you agree to do the film or the play? What attracts you in the first place is the words, and you have to respect the words. Look the other actor in the eye. You know, these very basic building blocks of acting. So they agreed absolutely, even though they're totally different emotional colors, had different emotional colors as actors. it's interesting. When they worked together, they made three pictures together. When they worked together, Fonda shifts gears and becomes more like Stewart. He becomes more puckish and more eccentric in the same way that Stewart's eccentric. Stewart did not go onto Fonda's turf. Fonda moved to Stewart's turf when they acted together.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and today we're featuring part two of our interview with Scott Eyman, author of Hank and Jim, The 50-Year Friendship of Henry Fonda and James Stewart. So there's another area that could have divided them. We're always told if there's two things you're going to stay away from with friendships, it's politics and religion. Well, we covered the politics part. On the religion part, these guys were pretty different as well.
Oh, yeah. Fonda was an agnostic trending towards atheism. He was convinced that any talk of God and an afterlife was childish. He didn't put any stock in it, whatever. When he was ill and his time was clearly getting close, he said, he told his wife, Shirley, I don't care what you do with me. Put me in the goddamn compost heap any minute. I mean, a lot of people make these defiant statements, right, you know, when they think they're getting very sick. He meant it. He really didn't care what happened to him after death, because he was convinced there was nothing. You know, that after death, it's just like before you're born. There is no consciousness. It's just the obliteration of consciousness. Stewart was very religious. He went to church every Sunday. For a long time, his wife did as well. After her son, Stewart's stepson, she was married one time before they married, and she had twin boys. And the one boy was killed in Vietnam. And after that, she stopped going to church. Stewart's twin daughters, with his wife, Gloria, also didn't go to church. And he said that he regarded his family not following his religion as one of the great disappointments of his life. And he meant it. You know, he really regarded it as a terrible flaw in the way he raised his kids. How he worked it out with his wife, he probably let it go, you know, because that was her response to her child dying. But it was a real problem that he had with his kids' lack of religion.
One of the things I found fascinating about Stewart is how he never lived up to his dad's expectations. The stories you tell of his dad closing the hardware store down on Saturday afternoon and going to the movies and then calling the son, or the son calls him and he's complaining about this and that, and there was one movie in particular he liked, but the rest of them, maybe not so much. And then there's Fonda, who's so tough on his kids. So you have this situation where you've got one guy who's trying to live up to his dad's expectations, and you got Fonda, the dad, who simply wasn't able to relate to his kids for most of his life.
That's quite true. That's quite true. No, Stewart's father, as I said, had been in two wars, Spanish-American and World War I. And he'd expected the kid to either be an architect, you know, which is what he paid for him to go to Princeton for, or come back to Indiana, Pennsylvania, and take over the hardware store from him, you know. And the fact that he went off on some flighty thing like show business was just a violation of every precept Stewart's father had. And he never accepted it. Never, ever accepted
Amazing.
It. Stewart, I think, on some level felt that the only time he ever pleased his father was by going into the Air Force and becoming a B-24 pilot. Other than that, his father never would have respected him. Never would have respected anything he did. But that was the great bond between them, is that Jimmy Stewart finally lived up to his father's expectations, but he had to go to war and survive in order to do it. Just becoming a world-famous movie star and a beloved actor was grossly insufficient in his father's eyes.
Right. Well, we're all familiar with Henry Fonda's kids, obviously Jane Fonda and Peter Fonda. We're not so familiar, of course, with the offspring of Gloria and Jimmy Stewart. But there is one daughter that I was just fascinated by, I suppose, because I'm sitting here at a university, and she became, I believe, a cultural anthropologist. But Kelly Stewart, if you could tell us a little bit about how she took off from her father's acting career, far from it.
No, he didn't want his kids to go into show business.
Yeah.
He thought it was a very difficult, very demanding profession with a lot of disappointment. And he was very happy when none of them went in, you know, went into the show business, which is interesting because he kind of became his own father and thought it was no business for a kid of his. No, none of the kids went into show business. Kelly got interested in anthropology through Robert Ardrey's books. And she started reading about Louis Leakey, and she went to Africa and interned with Leakey and his crew. And then she met the guy who became her husband, who was working with Diane Fossey, you know, 500 miles away, in her study of the great apes. And she's been married to him for probably 35 or 40 years. And she teaches in, Sacramento, at UC Sacramento. But she also got her parents, Jim and Gloria, into Africa. And Jim loved Africa. You know, after he kind of walked away from acting, his hearing deteriorated to a great extent, probably, I suspect, because of the B-24s.
I'm sure.
Because those things just right. had an ungodly amount of noise in them, you know. Mm-hmm. And they had headphones on for radio conversations, but still, it had to be very damaging to the hearing. Anyway, he loved Africa, and they went on a number of camera safaris as a family to visit her, to visit Kelly. In Africa, and then even after Kelly came back to America and went for her doctorate, Jim and Gloria continued going to Africa for safaris, for camera safaris. He adored it. Kelly told me, she said, he loved Africa because there's nobody there, just the animals, you know?
Wasn't there a bush baby story in there
somewhere?
Yeah,
he brought a bush baby back, and that became a family legend because Stewart tended to spin out these long, elongated stories, which sometimes had no relation to the truth. Although this one evidently actually is true, that he smuggled the bush baby onto the airplane because you weren't allowed to ship an animal home on the same flight you were on. You had to ship it on some special, you know, cargo plane. But he smuggled the bush baby on under his jacket, and after everybody slept for the overnight, went to sleep in the overnight flight, the bush baby got out from under his jacket somehow and was crawling around the plane, and he had to go on his hands and knees down the aisle looking for the bush baby at 3 in the morning on the plane while everybody's snoring. And this became a routine, and Gloria would say that was just utter, it never happened. But Kelly said, actually, it's very close to the truth.
So I want to talk a little bit about the business, the studio system. These guys grew up in the studio system. Help our listeners understand what that means and then how it changed.
Well, the studio system was basically in place for 60 or 70 years. It involved a mass production. It involved every studio at the point we're talking now from the 1920s through the 1950s, and then dribbled away evolution in a kind of evolutionary way over the next 25 years. But each studio made a lot of pictures. You made 40 or 50 pictures a year apiece. So there were 400 or 500 movies being made in America. To make that kind of volume, you needed a lot of personnel. So each studio had contract actors, contract directors, contract writers, contract cameramen. And you could, you know, Daryl Zanuck had a large desk. There was a glass top on the desk. Underneath the glass top was a roster, were various lists of all the contract people he had, actors, writers, directors, producers, and what they were doing that week. It was changed weekly. And he could look at the top of his desk and see where everybody was and where they were working. And that's how he could cast a picture and, you know, staff a picture. Well, so-and-so is not working. He can produce it. And you can get these two guys to write it. And if Ty Power is going to be through on July 1st, and we're not supposed to start till August 15th or August 30th, then his Ty Power could front the picture. That's how they made the pictures, you know? And that's why the studios were always on the lookout for bright young talent in whatever discipline movie making entails, writing, direction, production, acting. And that's how they went out there. Beginning in the 50s, well, actually, the very late 40s, 1949, 1950, 51, television decimates the industry. A third of the audience disappears. They stay home to watch television. So suddenly the economics don't exist anymore. You know, it's much like running a newspaper today. The economic structure is completely sliced away. What do? You start diminishing your overhead in order to survive. You cut this, you cut that, you make fewer pictures. You employ fewer actors, fewer directors. Finally, you get rid of everybody under contract and you just go freelance, you know, to cut your overhead in order to survive. That's what happened. So guys like Stewart and Fonda, who were used to, especially Stewart, who was under contract for a long time at MGM, after the war, he becomes a freelance and hopped around where he wanted to. But before the war, he was at MGM and, you know, jumping from this movie to Philadelphia Story to get loaned out to Frank Capra to make Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, back to MGM to do a picture with Eddie Lamar, back to MGM to do a picture with Lana Turner or whoever it might be. after the war, and certainly by 1950, things are changing, and the actors had to adapt. And some of them adapted very well and made a lot more money than they ever would have under contract. And some of them couldn't adapt and fell by the wayside or moved into television. You know, so that's a potted version of the story of the movie industry. But Stewart was a big star for as long as he cared to be a big star until he got to be in his 60s. And I mean, his audience stopped going to the movies because people in their 60s don't go to the movies very often because movies are a young person's business. And what you want is repeat business. People will go to see the same movie two or three times. And adults don't do that. Right. You know, 18-year-olds do that.
Right.
So, and 18-year-olds don't want, necessarily want to look at a 65-year-old guy with white hair. You know? So, and Fonda, because of his stage work, could always, you know, if there wasn't a movie script, well, fine, he'd go do a play or two, you know, and burn up the year that way. And then maybe a good movie script would come along next year. And that was fine with him. But Stewart was a creature of the movies. He wasn't particularly interested in doing theater. Fonda was devoted to doing theater.
Right. I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm continuing my conversation with Scott Eiman about his biography, Hank and Jim. The book chronicles the 50-year friendship between Henry Fonda and James Stewart. Well, let's talk about one of Stewart's movies, the first one he did after the war. You mentioned it already, It's a Wonderful Life, but the reason I'm bringing it up this time was, first of all, it's probably the Stewart movie most people have seen more than any other one because it runs every Christmas for sure. 2 or 3 weeks at a time. But in that movie, he negotiated with the producers, and I think it was a percentage of the gross he took away from that, mm-hmm. which had never happened before. Help us explain. I don't understand the finances of movies, obviously. Help us understand what he pulled off and why that eventually really made him one of the wealthiest actors in Hollywood.
Well, before World War II, only a very few people, actors, got a percentage of what a movie earned. Ronald Coleman, in the late 30s, started getting a percentage. Irene Dunne started getting a percentage. Claudette Colbert started getting a percentage. By 1940-41, Cary Grant is starting to get a small 3%, not a huge percentage, but, you know, 3 or 4%, depending on how, you know, the returns were defined. You know, there's gross, there's net, you know, and the studios always tried, of course, to pay as little as possible, but it was harder then than it is now. After the war, is if an actor, actors began to expect getting a percentage, you know, and it began to get harder and harder to make any money for these guys that had been running the studios for 20 or 30 years. And they didn't adapt to the idea of actors getting a piece of the action very well, because what was the actor's risk exactly? You know, they hadn't invested in the property. They hadn't invested in having the script written. They hadn't invested in getting the physical production up. They hadn't invested anything in the studio. So by what right did they expect to get a piece of the property, piece of the action? And there's something to be said for that. But that's what drove a lot of guys out of the business, guys like Daryl Zanuck, who just got more and more frustrated by the fact that it got between television cutting away a third of the audience, between having to sell off their movie theaters because of an antitrust action by the government, and between actors demanding 5% and 10% of the profits. And that's not just one actor. See, if you're hiring two actors or three actors, big actors for a film, you're going to be giving away a big hunk of the film. I'm doing some research on North by Northwest now, okay?
Oh.
The Hitchcock picture. Mm-hmm. And Cary Grant had 10% of the picture. Hitchcock had 10% of the picture. Everybody else was flat salary, but they're giving away, and they're paying big salaries on top of the percentages, MGM. So they're looking at this, and it gets harder and harder to make a dime, you know,
right.
Because it's not just straight salary. It churns out in perpetuity. It churns out in perpetuity if the deal's written that way. Grant's deal was in perpetuity. Hitchcock's deal was in perpetuity. So every time North by Northwest runs on television, somewhere there's a check going out to Alfred Hitchcock and Cary Grant. And, I mean, Hitchcock, the film wouldn't exist without Hitchcock. And Cary Grant adds a lot to the movie. But there are other actors that could have played that part. Maybe not as well, but there are other actors that could have played that part. Nobody else could have directed that movie but Alfred Hitchcock. But this is the problem that the studios had increasingly in the 1950s, is you, in order to get your premier talent, brought some box office with it, you had to cut them in on the action.
And didn't Stewart take a percentage of the gross as opposed to a percentage of the net, or did I read that wrongly?
Yeah, he would get a piece of the producer's gross, which is what comes back after the theaters take their cutout.
I see.
You know, the theaters would get paid first, and then whatever came back to the studio, he would get a percentage of.
Yeah. Now, It's a Wonderful Life. Did that go into the public domain or whatever you call it? So that's really not a movie.
Yeah, it was a flop. It lost money.
Yeah. Right.
He made money. He did very well on it because he had a piece of the gross.
Yeah.
Even though it lost about $350,000. But the company was an independent production, Frank Capra's Liberty Productions, Liberty Films. It was the only picture Liberty Films made. They couldn't get another loan because It's a Wonderful Life. It was not a people went to see it, but it was a very expensive movie. Mm-hmm. And when you see it, you can understand why he built that town. And it was a big set, and it was an expensive picture and went over budget. And people went, but just not enough to cover the cost. So Liberty Films went belly up, and it went into the public domain because when the copyright renewal came up in the 60s, it wasn't renewed. So it went public domain. It finally got recopyrighted again because it was a complicated issue involving the musical score and the underlying literary property, the short story that it's based on, was still under copyright. So the company was able to get it under copyright, but only after about 20, 25 years of public domain status.
So we're going to wrap this up with one final question. I just have to ask this, and there may not be an answer to it, Scott. If Hank and Jim came back to life and picked up a copy of your book and read that subtitle, The 50-Year Friendship of Henry Fonda and James Stewart, and read the book for that matter, what do you think they'd say?
What an interesting question. I think they'd both be pleased that they were remembered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they'd be pleased that people valued what they embodied. Because I think that's what everybody hopes will come out of their life. Mm-hmm. Most people don't have necessarily hope for any great social impact, but they hope that their kids, their values are carried on and their beliefs are carried on through their children, you know? Fonda and Stewart got the best of both worlds because the kids did that. I mean, Jane, in her absolute refusal to compromise in her belief system, is definitely her father's child. I mean, they had their innings together. They didn't always get along. But, I mean, that's his girl. As well as having a huge, huge talent, which she fully expressed in the same uncompromising way that he did. But they're also their belief in their system and what they embodied is infiltrated the culture as a whole, whether it's Tom Joad or Juror Number 8 in 12 Angry Men or Stewart's performances in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and It's a Wonderful Life or Anatomy of a Murder or Rear Window for Hitchcock. Each of them left a legacy, and legacy is I think what everybody hopes to leave behind, and they managed to do that. So I think they'd be thrilled that all these years after they've shuffled off, that people still care enough to write books about them and to read books about them.
Well, to quote you toward the end of your book, you say in describing them, they had a shared concern with what can only be called moral purpose, and those movies you just mentioned are living proof of that. You brought out, I mean, of course, we're reading this book to take something away of the humanity of these two guys, but you're the one that brought it out. I mean, you've so beautifully depicted the decency of these two gentlemen, the respect they had for each other, the trust they had for each other. They will indeed be remembered if listeners are smart enough to pick up this book. And the name of this book is Hank and Jim, The 50-Year Friendship of Henry Fonda and James Stewart by Scott Eyman. Scott, thank you so much for your generous approach to this interview, taking so much time. It means a great deal, and I know it'll mean even more when people can get a copy of your book. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Bob. Anytime.
Next week, my guest is Nancy Kane, author of Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Our producer is Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. If you missed some of our previous shows, you'll find them on our website. That's boisestatepublicradio.org.